feather. Her complexion was too pale to seem healthy, but the texture of her skin was remarkable. She reminded me of an obscure one-role movie actress of the 40s, someone you're surprised to find alive after all these years. She put a trembling hand on mine, her fingers so icy that I drew back in alarm. Her breathing was rapid and shallow.
"Irene, my God, your hands are like ice. Are you all right?"
"This happens now and then. I'll be fine in a minute."
"Let's find you a place to sit down," I said. We were approaching a three-story clapboard house, tall and narrow, with a porch on three sides. The yard was sunny, with the grass newly mown, and not much attention to the flower beds. I knew it was a board and care, because Rosie and I had been given the address. I'd never actually seen the inside of the house. Once Rosie realized there was no wheelchair access, we had crossed it off our list. I remembered the owner as an energetic fellow in his 70s, pleasant enough, but apparently not equipped to handle anyone who wasn't ambulatory. I'd already opened the shrieking iron gate, and I could see the front curtain move as someone peered out. This seemed to be a neighborhood where people were on the watch. I couldn't believe Agnes had managed to get even half a block without someone spotting her. We reached the front porch, and Irene sank down on the bottom step. She put her head between her knees. I put a hand on the back of her neck, peering closely at her face. I could hear the wheezing in her throat. "You want to lie down?"
"No, please, I'll be fine. It's my asthma acting up. I don't want a fuss made. Just let me sit here for a bit."
"Just slow your breathing down, okay? You're starting to hyperventilate. I don't want you passing out." I checked the street for Clyde, but he was nowhere to be seen. I climbed the steps and crossed to the front door. The owner of the board and care emerged just as I was preparing to ring the bell. He was a man who might have been hefty in his youth. Once muscular shoulders had softened with age, sloping beneath his shirt. He was clean-shaven and balding, his extended forehead giving him a look of babyhood. He had pouches under his eyes, and a mole stuck to his left cheek like a raisin.
"Something I can help you with?"
His eyes strayed to Irene, and I found myself following his gaze. If she fainted, I was going to have a real problem on my hands. "She'll be all right. She's feeling light-headed and just needs to sit down for a bit," I said. "A woman's disappeared from the nursing home down the block, and we're checking with the neighbors, hoping someone's seen her." He had focused on my face, surveying me quizzically.
"You look familiar. Do I know you?"
"Kinsey Milhone," I said. "I was here a couple of weeks ago with a friend of mine."
"Right, right, right. I remember now. Spunky little redhead with a sister in a wheelchair. I was sorry we couldn't accommodate her. She the one who's missing?"
"No, this is someone else," I said. I held a hand up above my own head, describing her again. "Tall, very thin. She's been gone since early this morning, and we can't seem to get a line on her. I can't believe she got far."
"Some of those old folk move fast," he said. "They can fool you if you don't keep an eye out. Wish I could help you, but I've been working in the back. Have you called the police?"
"They were notified first thing. I understand they've searched this whole area. We thought we'd try again."
"Happens occasionally, especially in this neighborhood. Usually they turn up."
"Let's hope. Thanks anyway." His gaze strayed back to Irene, still sitting on the bottom step.
"How about a glass of water for your friend?"
"She'll be okay, but thanks," I said. I closed the conversation with my usual request for assistance. "Here, let me leave you my card. If you see the woman or talk to anyone who might have noticed her, would you let me know? If I'm not available, you can always call the nursing home." He took my card.
"Certainly," he said.
Someone spoke to him from inside, a feeble voice, faintly petulant. He excused himself and went in. I helped Irene up. We made our way down the walk and out the gate. She was shaky on her feet, her face drawn and tense. "I really think I ought to take you back," I said. She shook her head emphatically.
"Not yet. I'm feeling better."
She straightened her back as if to illustrate the point. I could see a fine mist of sweat beading on her forehead, but she seemed determined to go on. I had my doubts, but there wasn't much I could do. "One more, then," I said, "and then we'll check back with Clyde." The house next door was a blocky bungalow with a low-pitched roof, a story and a half sheathed in fawn-brown clapboard. The porch was open and wide, the overhang supported on squat brick stanchions with wooden railings between. We were heading up the walk when I saw one of the wooden porch rails split, raw wood opening up like a flower blossoming. I heard a popping sound and glass broke.
I jumped, thinking that some shift in the earth was causing the structure to snap apart. I heard Dietz's Porsche roar around the corner to our left. I turned to look for him and registered peripherally the UPS delivery truck still idling at the curb. The UPS man was coming up the walk behind us. He was smiling at me, and I felt myself smile automatically in response. He was a big man, muscular, clean-shaven, with blonde curly hair, stark blue eyes and a tan face, full mouth curving into dimpled cheeks. I thought I must know him, because he seemed glad to see me, his eyes soft, the look on his face both sensual and warm. He moved nearer, bending toward me, almost as if he meant to kiss me. He was so close I registered the heady bouquet of his personal scent, gunpowder, aqua velva aftershave, and a whiff of juicy fruit chewing gum. I felt myself drawing back, perplexed. Behind me, wood snapped like a tree being cracked by lightning. I could see his face suffuse with heat, like a lover at the moment of his climax. He said something. I glanced down at his hands. He seemed to be holding the nozzle of a hose, but why would a UPS man wear gardening gloves? Light spurted from the hose. I blinked uncomprehendingly, and then I understood. I grabbed Irene by the arm, nearly lifting her off her feet. I hauled her up those two low stairs and toward the front door. The occupant of the house, a middle-aged man, was opening the front door, puzzled by the noise. I could tell from his expression he wasn't expecting company. I snagged him by his shirt front and shoved him aside, pushing him out of the line of fire as I shouldered us through the door. A front window shattered, spraying glass across the floor. Irene and I went down in a heap. She was too surprised to shriek, but I could hear the wind being knocked out of her as she hit the bare hardwood floor. The door banged back on its hinges, exposing the hallway and the stairs. The owner of the house had taken refuge in the living room, crouched beside the sofa, his arms folded across his head. He reminded me of a little kid who believes he's invisible just because his eyes are squeezed shut. A bullet ripped a hole through the back wall. Plaster dust blew inward like a bomb going off, with a fine cloud rising in its wake. There was silence. I heard someone running, pounding steps receding in the grass, and I knew instinctively that Dietz would give chase. Crouching, I duck-waddled my way into the dining room and peered cautiously out the side window, eyes barely above the sill. I saw Dietz round the corner of the house and disappear. Behind me, Irene was beginning to wail from fear, from injury, from shock and bewilderment. Belatedly, I felt a rush of adrenaline that made my heart thunder in my throat. My mouth went dry. I clung to the windowsill and laid my cheek against the cold wall, which was papered in cabbage roses, maroon and pink on a field of gray. I closed my eyes. In my mind, the moment was being played out all over again. First the man, that warm light in his eyes, mouth curving up in a familiar smile, the sense that he meant to kiss me, husky voice saying something, then the muzzle flash. From the sound, I knew he'd had a suppressor on the gun, but I'd seen light spurt out. Didn't seem likely in daylight unless my mind had somehow supplied the image out of past experience. How many shots had he fired? Five? Six? Dietz came into the house, striding across the room. He was winded, tightly controlled, sweating, his manner grim. He pulled me to my feet, his face stony. I could feel his hands digging into my upper arms, but I couldn't voice a protest.
Are you okay?
He gave me a shake, and I nodded, feeling mute. He set me aside like a rag doll, and moved away, crossing to Irene, who was weeping as piteously as a three-year-old. She sat on the floor with her legs spread, skirt askew, arms limp in her lap, her palms turned up. Dietz put an arm around her, pulling her close. He kept his voice low, reassuring her, bending down so she could hear. He asked her a question. I saw her shake her head. She was gasping, unable to say more than a few words before she was forced to stop for breath. The owner of the house was standing in the hallway, his fear having given way to outrage.
"What's going on here? What is this, a drug bust? I open my door and I nearly get myself killed. Look at the damages. Who's going to pay for this?"
Dietz said, "Shut up and call the cops."
"Who are you? You can't talk to me that way. This is a private residence."
I sank down on a dining-room chair. Through the front window I could see that neighbors had begun to congregate, murmuring anxiously among themselves, little groups of two and three, some standing in the yard. What had the man said to me? I ran it back again. I'd heard Dietz's car rumbling in the street, and that's when I'd turned, smiling at the man who was smiling at me.
I could hear his words now, understood at last what he'd said to me as he approached.
"You're mine, babe."
His tone possessive, secretive, and then the incredible sexual heat in his face. I felt tears rise, blurring my vision. The window shimmered. My hands began to shake. Dietz patted Irene's arm and returned to me. He hunkered at my side, his face level with mine.
"You did great. You were fine. There was no way you could have known that would happen, okay?"
I had to squeeze my hands between my knees so the shaking wouldn't travel up my arms. I looked at Dietz's face, gray eyes, the blunt nose.
"He tried to kill me."
"No, he didn't. He tried to scare you. He could have killed you the first time in Brawley on the road. He could have nailed you just now with the first shot he fired. If he kills you, the game is over. That isn't what he wants. He's not a pro. He's sick. We can use that to get him. Can you understand what I'm saying? Now we know his weakness."
"Yeah, it's me," I said, forever flip. Actually, I didn't understand much of anything. I'd looked into the face of death. I'd mistaken him for a friend. Other people had tried to kill me out of vengeance, out of hate. It had never really seemed personal until the man on the walk. No one had ever connected to me as intimately as he had. I glanced over at Irene. Her respiratory distress, instead of subsiding, seemed to be getting worse. Her breathing was rapid, shallow, and ineffectual, the wheezing in her throat like two high-pitched notes on a bagpipe. Her fingertips were turning a shadowy blue. She was suffocating where she sat.
"She needs help," I said.
Dietz turned to look at her.
"Oh, hell."
He was on his feet instantly, striding across the room. The owner of the house was standing at the telephone, repeating his address to the police dispatcher. Dietz said,
"We need an ambulance, too." And then to Irene, "Take it easy. You'll be fine. We'll have help for you soon. Don't panic."
I saw Irene nod, which was as much as she could manage. In the midst of the confusion, Clyde Gersh appeared, drawn by the scattering of neighbors who were standing out in front. He told me later that when he saw the damages to the house, his first thought was that Agnes had been discovered and had put up some kind of fight. The last thing he expected was to see Irene on the floor in the midst of a stage 3 asthma attack. Within minutes, the cops arrived, along with the paramedics, who administered oxygen and first aid, loaded Irene on a gurney, and hustled her away. In the meantime, I felt strangely removed. I knew what was expected, and I did as I was told. I rendered a detailed account of events in a monotone, letting Dietz fill in the background. I'm not sure how much time passed before Dietz was allowed to take me home. Time had turned sluggish, and it seemed like hours. I never even heard the name of the guy who owned the house. The last glimpse I saw of him, he was standing on the porch, looking like the sole survivor of an 8.8 earthquake. Chapter 14. When we got home, I fumbled my way up to the loft. I pulled my shoes off. I stretched out on the bed, propping the pillows up behind me while I took stock of myself. All the niggling aches and pains in my body were gone, washed away by the wave of adrenaline that had tumbled over me during the attack. I was feeling drained, lethargic, my brain still crackling while my body was immobilized. Downstairs, I heard the murmur of Dietz talking on the phone. I must have dozed, sitting upright. Dietz appeared. I opened my eyes to find him perched on the bed beside me. He was holding some papers in one hand and a mug of tea in the other.
"Drink this," he said.
I took the mug and held it, focusing on the heat. Tea has always smelled better than it tastes. I can still remember how startled I was as a kid when I was first allowed to have a sip. I glanced up at the skylight, which showed a circle of lavender and smoke.
"What time is it?" 7:10.
"Have we heard from Clyde?"
"He called a little while ago. She's fine. They treated her and sent her home." "No sign of Agnes yet. How are you?"
"Better."
"That's good. We'll have some supper in a bit. Henry's bringing something over."
"I hate being taken care of."
"Me too, but that's bullshit. Henry likes to feel useful. I'm starving and neither of us cook. You want to talk?"
I shook my head. "My soul's not back in my body yet."
"It'll come. I got a line on the guy from the L.A. police. You want to take a look?"
All right.
There was a sheaf of LAPD bulletins, maybe six. I studied the first. Wanted, felony traffic suspects. There were 10 mugshots, like class photos, one circled in ballpoint pen. It was him. He looked younger. He looked pale. He looked glum, one of life's chronic offenders at the outset of his career. His name was Mark Darien Messenger, alias Mark Darien, alias Darien Marker, alias Buddy Messer, alias Darien Davidson. Male, Caucasian, 38 years old, blonde hair, blue eyes, tattoo of a butterfly on the web of his right hand. I'd missed that. His date of birth was July 7, Cancer, a real family man at heart. His California driver's license number was listed, his Social Security number, his NCIC file number, FBI number, his department report number, his warrant number. The arrest, apparently in the summer of 1981, was for violation of Vehicle Code Section 20001, hit and run resulting in death, and Penal Code Section 1923A, vehicular manslaughter while driving under the influence. The photograph was an inch and a half wide square, taken straight on. It helped to see him shrunk down to Lilliputian proportions, the size of a postage stamp. He looked like a low-life punk, the black-and-white mugshot not nearly as sinister as the flesh-and-blood reality. The second police bulletin read, "Arrest for murder of a police officer, felony warrant, LACA, with a string of numbers, charging Penal Code Section 187A, murder, and Section 664/187, attempted murder, with a six-line narrative attached." On October 9, 1981, two Los Angeles police officers responded to a domestic disturbance during which the above suspect fired an unknown-type semi-automatic at his common-law wife. When the police officers attempted to subdue him, suspect shot one of the officers in the face, resulting in his death. The suspect then fled on foot. The names of two detectives assigned to the case were listed below that, along with several telephone numbers if information came to light. At the bottom of the page was a line in bold print. "Kindly notify Chief of Police, Los Angeles, California," it said. Kindly kill this man on sight, I thought. The third bulletin was dated less than 2 months back. $1 million robbery information wanted. And there he was again, in a police composite drawing, this time with a mustache, which he must have shaved off in the interim. According to the victim's account, the suspect had followed a wholesale gold dealer into a gold exchange business in the Jewelry Mart section of downtown Los Angeles on March 25th, where he relieved the victim of the gold he was transporting, valued in excess of $625,000. The suspect had produced a gun and robbed the victim and another employee of an additional $346,000 in gold granules and $46,000 in cash. Mark Messenger had been identified from fingerprints at the scene. I leafed through the remaining bulletins. There was apparently no crime Mark Messenger was incapable of committing. The well-rounded felon, with a major in murder and minors in armed robbery and assault with a deadly weapon. He seemed to operate with equal parts impulse and brute force. He didn't go in for the intellectual stuff, nothing with finesse. The million-dollar robbery was probably the most sophisticated thing he'd ever done. "Now we know how he can afford to take on a cut-rate hit," I said. Dietz tapped the paper, pointing to one of the last lines of print. A brief note indicated that the suspect was reported to have relatives in Santa Teresa.
"That's how he knew Tyrone Patty, from here. They were cellmates in the county jail 4 years ago. I guess they kept in touch."
"Have the cops here talked to his family?" Dietz nodded.
"No luck. His father claims he hasn't talked to Messenger in years. He's probably lying, but you can't do much about that. Dolan says they delivered a stern lecture about aiding and abetting. The old man swore a Boy Scout oath he'd notify the cops if the guy showed up."
I could feel a knot of dread begin to form in my gut. "Let's talk about something else."
"Let's talk about fighting back."
"Tomorrow," I said. "Right now, I'm not in the mood."
"Drink your tea and get cleaned up. I'll see you downstairs."
Henry had put together a meal of comfort foods. succulent meatloaf with mushroom gravy, mashed potatoes, fresh green beans, homemade rolls, fresh lemon meringue pie, and coffee. He ate with us, saying little, watching me with worried eyes. Dietz must have cautioned him not to chide me for leaving the premises. It was clear Henry wanted to fuss, but he had the presence of mind to keep his mouth shut. I felt guilty anyway, as if the attempt on my life was something I had done. Henry studied the police bulletins, memorizing Mark Messenger's face and the details of his alleged crimes.
"A nasty piece of work. You mentioned a little boy. How does he figure into this?"
he said to Dietz.
"He kidnapped the kid from his common-law wife. Her name is Rochelle. She works in a massage parlor down in Hollywood. I talked to her a little while ago, and the woman's a mess. The kid's name is Eric. He's 5. He was enrolled in a daycare center in Rochelle's neighborhood. Messenger picked him up about 8 months ago, and that's the last she's seen of him. I got boys of my own. I'd kill anyone came after them."
Dietz ate like he did everything else, with intense concentration. When he finished the last scrap of food, he sat back, patting automatically at the shirt pocket where he'd kept his cigarettes. I saw a quick headshake, as if he were amused at himself. They moved on to other subjects. Sports, the stock market, political events. While they talked, I gathered the empty plates and utensils and took them to the kitchenette. I ran a sink full of soapy water and slid the dishes in. There's nothing so restful as washing dishes when you need to separate yourself from other folk. It looks dutiful and industrious, and it's soothing as a bubble bath. For the moment, I felt safe. I didn't care if I ever left the apartment again. What was wrong with staying right here? I could learn to cook and clean house. I could iron clothes, if I had any. Maybe I could learn to sew and make craft items out of popsicle sticks. I just didn't want to go out again. I was beginning to feel about the real world as I did about swimming in the ocean. Off the Santa Teresa coast, the waters of the Pacific are murky and cold, filled with USTs, unidentified scary things, that can hurt you real bad. Organisms made of jelly and slime, crust-covered creatures with stingers and horny pincers that can rip your throat out. Mark Messenger was like that, vicious, implacable, dead at heart. Henry left at 10 o'clock. Dietz turned the TV on, waiting up for the news while I went back to bed. I stirred twice during the night, glancing at the clock, once at 1:15 a.m. and again at 2:35. The light was still on downstairs, and I knew Dietz was awake. He seemed to thrive on very little sleep, while I never got quite enough. The light coming over the loft rail was a cheery yellow. Anyone coming after me would be forced to contend with him. Reassured, I drifted off again. Given my anxiety level, I slept well and woke with some of my old energy, which lasted almost until I got downstairs. Dietz was still in the shower. I made sure the front door was locked. I considered loitering outside the bathroom, listening to him sing, but I was afraid he'd catch me at it and perhaps take offense. I made a pot of coffee, set out the milk, the cereal boxes, and the bowls. I peered out one of the windows, opening the wooden shutter just a crack. All I could see was a slit of the flower bed. I pictured Messenger across the street with a bolt-action sniper rifle with a 10-power scope trained so he could blow my head off the minute I stirred. I retreated to the kitchenette and poured some orange juice. I hadn't felt this threatened since my first day in elementary school. Coming out of the bathroom, Dietz seemed surprised to find me up. He was wearing chinos and a form-fitting white T-shirt. He looked solid and muscular, without an ounce of extra fat. He disarmed the portable alarm system, opened the door, and brought the paper in. I noticed I was careful to hang back out of the line of fire. Some forms of mental illness probably feel just like this. I pulled a stool out and sat down. He tossed the paper on the counter and then did a brief detour into the living room. He came back with the Davis, which he'd apparently taken from my purse. He placed it on the counter in front of me. He poured himself some coffee and sat down on the stool across from mine. I murmured, "Good morning." He nodded at the Davis. "I want you to dump that." "What for?"
"It's a pocket pistol, useless under the circumstances."
I resisted the temptation to say something flip. "I just got that."
"Get another one."
"But why?"
It's cheap and unreliable. It's not safe to carry with around in the chamber, which means you have to keep the magazine full, the chamber empty, and the safety off. If you're in trouble, I don't want you having to rack the slide to chamber around in order to put it into action. You can get a new holster while you're at it.
I stared at him. He didn't seem that impressed with the look I was giving him.
He said, "Where's the closest gun shop?"
"I don't have the money. You're talking $500 or $600.
"More like 1100 for the gun you should have."
"Which is what?"
"Heckler & Koch P7 and 9mm. You can get it used somewhere. It's the latest yuppie firearm. It looks good in the glove compartment of a BMW, but it's still right for you."
"Forget it," I said. This time he stared at me. I felt myself faltering. "Even if I bought a gun today, I'd have to wait 2 weeks to pick it up."
"You can use the Davis until then, but not with those cartridges. You should be using a high-velocity hollow point like the Winchester Silvertip, or a pre-fragmented round like the Glazer Safety Slug. I suggest the Winchester Silvertip."
"Why those?" Actually, it didn't matter. I was just feeling stubborn and argumentative. He ticked his reasons off, using his fingers for emphasis.
"It's less expensive, for one thing, and it's fairly widely used by law enforcement. With the underpowered 32 round, penetration is the most important."
"All right, I got it," I said irritably. "Is that all you did last night, sit around thinking up this stuff?"
"That's all I did," he said.
He opened the paper and checked the front page.
"Actually, I have a Colt 45 out in the car. You can practice with both guns when we go up to the firing range."
"When are we doing that?"
"After the gun shop opens at 10.
"I don't want to go out."
"We're not going to let the guy affect your life this way."
His gray eyes came up to mine.
"Okay?"
"I'm scared," I said.
"Why do you think we're doing this?"
"What about the banquet?"
"I think we should go. He won't make another move for days. He wants you to think about your mortality. He wants your anxiety to mount until you jump every time the phone rings."
"I already do that."
"Have some breakfast. You'll feel better."
I poured my cereal and some milk, still brooding while I ate. Dietz broke the silence, looking across the paper at me.
"I want to say one thing again, so listen carefully," he said. "A truly professional assassin kills either at close range or very long range. Up close, the weapon of choice would probably be a suppressed 22 long rifle with subsonic ammunition. From a distance, a bolt-action 308. Messenger is a badass, but he's also an amateur. I'm going to nail him."
"What if he gets you first?"
"He won't."
He went back to the sports section. I felt better, I swear to God. Chapter 15. Dietz and I went to the office first. I checked my answering machine, no messages, while he glanced at the mail from the day before, no letter bombs. I locked up again, and we went next door to the California Fidelity offices, where Vera was just getting in. She was wearing a two-piece outfit of red parachute material, long flowing skirt, blousy top with long sleeves, and a red belt at the waist. Since I'd seen her yesterday, her hair had turned very blonde, with streaks, and her glasses had changed to aviator shades with blue lenses. As usual, she looked like the kind of woman any guy would love to jump out of an airplane with, an effect that wasn't lost on Dietz. She was carrying a garment on a hanger covered by a cleaning bag.
"Oh, hi. You guys going tonight?"
"That's what we stopped by to tell you," I said. "Should I call the hotel?"
"I already did that," she said. "I figured you'd be there."
"This is for you." She indicated the cleaning bag.
"Come on back to my office and you can take a look.
This is girl stuff," she said to Dietz.
"You still off cigarettes?"
"Day 3, he said.
I hadn't realized he was counting.
"This is day 7 for me," she said.
"How are you doing?"
"Not too bad. I've got all this manic energy. I feel amped. I must have counted on the nicotine to mellow me out. What about you?"
"I'm okay," he said mildly. I like to do things to test myself.
I'll bet you do, she said and laughed down in her throat. We'll be back in a sec.
She breezed on toward the back.
Was that nasty, what you said to him?
It sounded nasty, I asked, scurrying to keep up.
She glanced over her shoulder. Listen, baby cakes, when I get around to nasty, you won't have any doubts.
She anchored the hanger over the edge of her cubicle and stuck an unlit Virginia Slim in her mouth, dragging on it cold. She closed her eyes as if praying.
Oh, God, for a light, for smoke, for the first heady hit of a cigarette.
She opened her eyes and shook her head.
I hate doing things that are good for me. Why did I decide to do this?
You were coughing up blood.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that part.
Ah, well, take a look. She eased the plastic bag off the hanger. Under it was a black silk jumpsuit with spaghetti straps and a tiny belt. The matching jacket had a mandarin collar and long sleeves.
What do you think?
It looks perfect.
Good. Make sure it fits. Otherwise, give me a call and I'll scare up something else. You can bring it with you at 6 and get dressed in my room. I'm staying at the Edgewater so I won't have to drive myself home afterward. I hate having to monitor my alcohol intake.
Don't you have a date? I thought you'd be coming with Neil.
I'm meeting him there. That way he's free to do anything he wants.
I'll bring the jewelry tonight and maybe help you do something with your hair.
I can tell I'm going to have to dress you.
Vera, I'm not helpless.
Of course you're not helpless. You're completely ignorant when it comes to clothes. I'll bet you've never even had your colors done.
I gave a little noncommittal shrug, trying to look like I had my colors done, sometimes twice a week.
Don't bother. You're a summer. I can save you the $50. You shouldn't wear black, but to hell with it. You'll look great.
She paused to study my face. Very becoming, those bruises, especially the one turning green. She began to ease the plastic bag back over the outfit, unlit cigarette bobbing from the corner of her mouth.
How's it feel to spend 24 hours a day with a hunk?
You mean Dietz?
Vera sighed and rolled her eyes. No, I'm talking about Don Knotts. Never mind. You probably like him because he's competent, right?
Well, yeah. Isn't that the point? I said.
You know what puzzles me? How come I'm surrounded by bossy people? Rosie, Dietz, Henry, now you.
You're cute, you know that. You think you're such a hard ass.
I am a hard ass, I said defensively.
Neil's going to love you. Have you called him yet?
I haven't had a chance. We just got back.
He's only coming tonight to meet you.
Just remember, don't eat.
I squinted at her.
How come? This is a retirement dinner, isn't it?
Suppose you want to go to bed with him.
I don't, I said.
But suppose you did.
What's that got to do with eating dinner?
She was losing patience with me, but stopped to spell it out.
Never go to bed with a guy after a big meal. Your stomach will pooch out.
Why would I go to bed with a guy I can't have a big meal with first?
You can eat later when you're married.
I had to laugh. I'm not getting married later, but thanks for the tip.
You're welcome. See you tonight.
I found Dietz sitting out by Darcy's desk, leafing through a pamphlet on uninsured losses. I took the outfit downstairs with us, tucking it carefully in his trunk when we reached the parking lot.
There's no way I'm wearing any body armor under this, I said.
Dietz made no comment, and I took that for assent.
On our way to the firing range, we stopped by the gun shop and spent an hour bickering about guns.
He knew far more than I did, and I had to yield to his expertise. I left a deposit on the H&K P7 in 9mm, filling out all the necessary paperwork. I ended up paying $25 for 50 rounds of the Winchester Silvertips Dietz had insisted on. In exchange for my compliance, he had the good taste not to mention that all of this was his idea. I'd expected to find it galling to take his advice, but in reality it felt fine. What did I have to prove? He'd been at it a lot longer than I had, and he seemed to know what he was talking about.
Dietz drove up the pass in his little red Porsche like a man pursued.
Maybe we were practicing for a car chase later on. The Porsche was not equipped with passenger brakes, but I kept my foot jammed to the floorboards in hopes.
From where I sat, it looked like one of those camera's eye views of the Indy 500, only speeding straight uphill. I was wishing I believed in an afterlife, as I was about to enjoy mine. Dietz didn't seem to notice my discomfiture. Since he was totally focused on the road, I didn't want to spoil his concentration with the piercing screams I was having to suppress. The gun club was deserted except for the rangemaster, to whom we paid our fees. The May sun was hot, the breezes dry, scented with bay laurel and sage. The rains wouldn't come again until Christmas time. By August, the mountains would be parched, the vegetation desiccated, the timber primed for burning. Even now, looking down toward the valley, I could see a haze in the air, ghostly portent of the fires to come. Dietz set up a B-27 human silhouette target at a distance of 7 yards.
End of Disc 4. Disc 5.
Dietz set up a B-27 human silhouette target at a distance of 7 yards. I'd been practicing with the Davis at 25 yards, but Dietz just shook his head.
A 32's designed for self-defense inside 15 yards, preferably inside 10. The round has to penetrate deeply enough to get to the vital organs and blood vessels, 8 to 10 inches in. The silver tip has a better chance of getting far enough to make a difference.
Nice business we're in, I said.
Why do you think I'm getting out?
I loaded the magazine on my little Davis while he detailed an exercise he referred to as a Mozambique drill. He had me start from the guard position, pistol loaded, round chambered, safety on, finger off the trigger, pointing at a 45-degree angle downward.
Bring the pistol up to shooting position and fire 2 quick shots into the upper chest, level with the sternum. Do a quick visual check to see where you've hit, and then fire a 3rd, more careful shot into the head right around here, he said, indicating his eye sockets.
I put on my ear protectors and did as I was told, feeling self-conscious at first under his scrutiny. It was clear that in the years since the police academy, my skills had deteriorated. I'd come up here often, on an average of once a month, but I'd begun to think of it almost as a meditation instead of schooling in self-defense. Left to my own devices, I'd been neither rigorous nor exact. Dietz was a good teacher. Patient, methodical, suggesting corrections in a way that never made me feel criticized.
Now, let's try it with your gun in your purse, he said when he was satisfied.
How do you know all this stuff? He smiled faintly.
Weapons are a passion of mine. My first formal training in defensive pistol craft was a class designed for certifying security guards to carry weapons on the job. The practical shooting part was minimal, but it did give me a fair grounding in the laws related to firearms. I went to the American Pistol Institute after that.
He paused.
Are we up here to work or chat?
I get to choose, I said. Apparently not. He had me try the 45, but it was too much gun for me coming off the 32. He relented on that point and let me continue with the Davis. We went back to work, the smell of gunpowder perfuming the air as I concentrated on the process. I'd ceased to think about Mark Messenger as a person. He'd become an abstract, no more than a flat black silhouette 7 yards away, with a paper heart, paper brain. It was therapeutic firing at him, watching his midriff shred. My fearfulness began to fall away, and my confidence returned. I fired at his paper neck and hit an inky artery. I pretended to tattoo my initials on his trunk. By the time we packed up and left the range at noon, I was feeling like my old self again. We had lunch at the Stagecoach Tavern, tucked up against the mountain with a stream trickling down through the rocks close by. Live oak and bay laurel kept the tavern shrouded in chill shade. The quiet was undercut by the gossiping of the birds. Only an occasional car climbed the grade out in front, heading for the main road. Dietz was still vigilant, scanning the premises, but he seemed more at ease somehow, sipping beer, 1 foot propped up on the crude wooden bench where he sat. I was seated on his left with my back to the wall, watching as he did, though there wasn't much to see. There were only 3 other customers, bikers sitting at one of the rough plank tables outside. We'd ordered the chili verde, which the waitress brought.
two wide bowls of fragrant pork and green chili stew, with a dollop of cilantro pesto on top, and two folded flour tortillas submerged in the depths. This might be as close to heaven as a sinner could get without repenting first.
"What's your deal with California Fidelity?" he asked between bites.
"They provide me office space, and I provide them services maybe two or three times a month. It varies. Usually I investigate fire and wrongful death claims, but it could be anything."
"Nice arrangement. How'd you set that up?"
"My aunt worked for them for years, so I knew a lot of those guys. She used to get me occasional summer jobs when I was still in high school. I went through the academy when I was 19, and since I couldn't actually join the PD till I was 21, I worked as the CF receptionist. Later, after I finally left the police force, I joined a private agency until I could get licensed, and then I went out on my own. One of the first big investigations I did was for CF."
"A lot more women getting into it," he said.
"Why not? It's fun, in some sick sense. You end up feeling pretty hard-bitten sometimes, but at least you can be your own boss. It's in my nature. I'm curious at heart, and I like sticking my nose in where it doesn't belong," I said. "What about you? What will you do if you leave the field?"
"Hard to say. I'm talking to a guy out in Colgate who sets up anti-terrorist training exercises for military bases overseas."
"Simulated attacks?"
"That's right. Dead of night, he takes a crew in, breaches perimeter fences, infiltrates the compound, and puts the whole maneuver on film to show 'em where they need to beef up their defenses."
"Cops and robbers without the firepower."
"Exactly. All the hype and none of the jeopardy."
He paused, mopping the bottom of his bowl with a folded tortilla.
"You look like you've got all your ducks in a row."
"I feel that way," I said. "Vera would disagree. She thinks I'm hopeless. Too independent, unsophisticated."
"What's the story on her?"
"I've never figured it out, to tell you the truth. She's the closest thing to a friend I've got, and even then I can't claim we know each other very well. I'm gone a lot, so I don't socialize much. She tends to circulate in the single scene, which I've never been good at. I do admire her. She's smart. She's got style. She doesn't take any guff."
"What is this, a sales pitch?"
I laughed, shrugging. "You asked."
"Yeah, well, she's one of those women I've never figured out."
"In what way?"
"Don't know. I never figured that out either. Just something about her puzzles me," he said.
"She's a good soul."
"No doubt."
He finished cleaning his bowl without another word on the subject. It was hard to tell sometimes what he was really thinking, and I didn't know him well enough to press. Chapter 16. We left for the hotel at 6. Dietz had already cleaned up and was dressed for the occasion in casual pants, a dress shirt, patterned tie, and dark sports coat, cut Western style, broad across the shoulders, tapered at the waist. He was wearing black boots, visible where his cuffs broke, the toes polished to a hard shine. Under his sport coat, of course, he was wearing a Kevlar vest that would stop a .357 Magnum at 10 feet. I'd also watched him strap on a holster that he wore behind the hip on his right-hand side, and into which he'd tucked his .45. I'd showered and hopped right back in my jeans, turtleneck, and tennis shoes, intending to slip into the silky jumpsuit once I reached Vera's room. I tried it on quickly just before we left the house. The pants were slightly too long, but I'd bunched 'em up at the waist, and that took care of it. I packed black pumps, pantyhose, black underpants, and some odds and ends in a little overnight case. Dietz had excused me from the bulletproof vest, which would have looked absurd with spaghetti straps. The Davis was tucked in an outside pouch of my big leather handbag, which looked more like a diplomatic pouch than an evening purse. The normally bulky bag was further plumped up by the inclusion of a night scope Dietz had asked me to carry. The scope only weighed about a pound, but it was the size of a zoom lens for a 35mm camera and made me list to one side. "Why are we taking this thing?" I asked.
"That's my latest toy. I usually keep it in the car, but I don't want to leave it in the hotel parking lot. Cost me over $3,000.
"Oh." Dietz took a roundabout route, saying little.
Despite his assurances that Mark Messenger would be laying off me for a day or two, he seemed on edge, which made my stomach churn in response. He was focused, intense, already vigilant. He pushed the car lighter in and then reached reflexively toward his cigarettes.
"Shit," he said.
He shook his head, annoyed with himself. He rounded a corner, downshifting.
"Times like this, I envy the guys who do government work," he remarked. "You'd have a squad of bodyguards. They've got unlimited manpower, access to intelligence sources, and the legal authority to kick butt."
I couldn't think what to say to that, so I kept my mouth shut. We pulled into the wide brick drive in front of the hotel, and Dietz got out, slipping the usual folded bill to the parking attendant with instructions to keep the car within sight. It was still light outside, and the landscape was saturated with late afternoon sun. The grass was close-cropped, a dense green, the lawn bordered with pink and white impatiens and clumps of lobelia, which glowed an intense electric blue. On the far side of the road, the surf battered at the sea wall, clouding the air with the briny smell of the thundering Pacific. In addition to the Edgewater's sprawling main building, there were a line of bungalows at the rear of the property, each the size of the average single-family dwelling in my neighborhood. The architecture was Spanish-style. White stucco exterior, heavy beams, age-faded red tile roofs, interior courtyards. Under an archway that led to the formal gardens, a wedding party was beginning to assemble. 5 bridesmaids in dusty pink and a manic flower girl skipping back and forth with a basket of rose petals. 2 young men in tuxedos, probably ushers, looked on, contemplating the efficacies of birth control. As usual, Dietz took me by the elbow, keeping himself slightly in front of me as he walked us toward the entrance. I found myself scanning, as he did, the smattering of guests in the immediate vicinity. He was keyed up, eyes watchful as we entered the spacious lobby, which was flanked by 2 oversized imported rose marble desks. We approached the concierge and had a brief chat. Dietz had apparently had a second conversation with the management up front, because shortly afterward, Charles Abbott, the director of security, appeared. Introductions went around. Abbott was in his late 60s and looked like a retired Fortune 500 executive in a 3-piece suit, complete with manicured nails and a Rolex watch. This was not a man you'd ever refer to as Charlie or Chuck. His silver hair was the same tone as the pale gray of his suit, and a diamond stick pin winked from the center of his tie. I had the feeling what he did now was lots more fun than whatever he did then. He led us over to a corner of the lobby where 3 big leather wing chairs were grouped together in the shelter of a 10-foot rubber plant. Dietz had brought photocopies of the mugshots of Mark Messenger.
"This is the guy we're worried about. I'd like to distribute these among the staff who'll be working the banquet tonight."
Abbott gave a cursory glance to the pictures before he handed them back. He had luminous blue eyes and made lots of eye contact.
"Mr. Dietz, I have to remind you that we're not equipped to handle any kind of sophisticated security measures for a private citizen. We cooperate with the Secret Service when the occasion arises, but the hotel can't accept any liability in the event of some kind of unfortunate incident. We're here primarily to protect the safety of our registered guests. As long as I'm kept informed, we'll be happy to do what we can. But beyond that, I can't promise much."
Dietz smiled.
"I understand that," he said pleasantly. "This is purely precautionary on our part. We don't anticipate any problems, but it's wise to tag a few bases just to ensure that everything goes smoothly."
Abbott said,
"Of course."
Dietz was on his best behavior, casual, relaxed. He must have really needed this man's help. Abbott's expression was bemused. He looked like the kind of man who'd use a cigarette holder and a small gold Dunhill.
"How else can I help? I can make one of my security staff available."
"I don't think that'll be necessary, but thanks. We do have a California Fidelity employee, Vera Lipton, registered here for the night. I'd like to have her room number and the names of guests occupying the rooms on either side of her. Is that something you can do?"
Abbott considered the request. Under the smooth and easygoing manner, there was ice and flint.
"I don't see why not."
He excused himself and moved over to the front desk. After a short conversation with the desk clerk, he jotted a note in a small leather notebook he'd taken from his right pocket. He returned, tore the leaf off, and handed it to Dietz.
"You know either of these couples?"
Dietz asked.
"I know both. The Clarks have stayed here many times. Mr. and Mrs. Thiedemann happen to be my aunt and uncle."
Dietz tucked the paper away and shook Abbott's hand.
"Thanks. We appreciate this." "Happy to be of help," the man said.
We moved down a carpeted hallway to the right, following the room numbers in descending order. Dietz kept an eye on the corridor behind us, the ever-present hand on my elbow for leverage. At any unexpected occurrence, he had a modicum of control. Vera's room was located in the same wing as the banquet room. "Did you set this up?" I asked him when I saw how close it was.
"I didn't want you hiking the length of the hotel, getting there and back."
He knocked once. There was a pause. My guess was that Vera was peering through the tiny fisheye porthole in the door. We heard a bolt turn, and there she was, squinting at us from behind the burglar chain. She was in a green silk kimono with a lot of cleavage visible where the fabric gaped in front. She glanced down and pulled the yawning lapels together with one hand.
"I kept the chain on. Wasn't that smart?"
Dietz said,
"You're a peach, Vera. Now let us in."
She tilted her head, gaze angling down the hall.
"How do I know somebody's not holding you at gunpoint?"
Dietz laughed. I looked at him quizzically. I'd only heard him laugh once.
"Good point," he said.
I personally didn't think the point was that good, but nobody was asking me, right? Vera closed the door so she could slide the chain off and then let us in. The room was enormous. King-size bed, king-size antique armoire housing a king-size television set. The dominant color was pale yellow. Thick, pale yellow carpet, wallpaper strewn with delicate white Japanese irises. The pattern of the wallpaper had been repeated in the polished cotton bedspread and matching polished cotton drapes, pulled back on brass rods. The shears were closed, lights outside indicating that the room faced the entrance drive. The two upholstered chairs were done in pale green, with white latticework cut on the diagonal. Through a doorway I spied a bathroom that continued the color scheme. A vase of white silk flowers, fat yellow hand towels rolled up in a willow basket on the sink. Vera had her personal effects on every conceivable surface. Discarded clothing tossed on the bed, hanging clothes hooked on the closet door, which stood open to the room. There were cosmetics on the chest of drawers, hot rollers and a curling iron on the bathroom counter, a damp towel on the toilet seat. A suitcase open on the luggage rack revealed a frothy tumble of soft chiffon lingerie. A pair of pantyhose had been flung on one of the upholstered chairs, sprawling there with the legs spread and the diamond-shaped cotton crotch looking like an arrow, pointing up. Dietz headed straight for the door to the adjoining room, making sure it was locked. Then he closed the drapes. Vera crossed to the coffee table. She'd had a bottle of champagne delivered, resting in a frosted silver ice bucket with four champagne flutes on a tray. She picked the bottle up by the neck and began to loosen the foil.
"Grab a seat. We can have a drink."
"Not for me, thanks. I have to work," he said.
And then to me,
"Keep the door locked. If the phone rings, you can answer it, but don't identify yourself. If it's someone you know, keep the conversation brief. Don't give out information of any sort to anyone. If you get a wrong number, let me know. It's probably someone checking to see if the room is still occupied."
He glanced at his watch.
"I'll be back at 7, straight up, to walk you over to the banquet room."
Once Dietz left the room, she held her arms up and shimmied.
"Let's get down," she said, and then did a little bump and grind, accompanied by a whoop.
She twisted the wire off the champagne bottle and draped a towel across the top, working the cork back and forth with both thumbs until it popped. She filled two flutes and handed me one.
"I've already done my makeup," she said. "Why don't you hop in the shower while I get dressed? Then we'll do your hair."
"I've already showered. All I have to do is put on the jumpsuit and I'm done." She gave me a look to let me know how wrong I was. Under her critical gaze, I slipped out of my jeans and into the jumpsuit. She only winced a little bit at the sight of my bruises. Meanwhile, my facial expression was probably the equivalent of an ailing dog on its way to the vet's. Ugh. Makeup.
I pulled the suit on and started tucking the pants up at the waist. She smacked my hand.
"Don't do that," she said.
She knelt and turned my pant legs under to a length that suited her, and then secured them with fabric tape she'd brought in her purse.
"You think of everything," I said.
"Prepared is my middle name, honey bun." Then she went to work on the rest of me. I sat on the closed toilet lid with a towel around my neck, Vera's body inserted between me and the wall-to-wall mirror that ran along the countertop.
"What are you going to do about the bruises on my face?"
"Trust me, kid." She had bottles and powders, lotions, creams, goo in jars, brushes, applicators, sponges, Q-tips. She worked with her face very close to mine, issuing instructions.
"Close your eyes. Now look up. God, quit blinking. You're making a mess."
She painted on lipstick with a brush, her own lips forming the shape she wanted me to form with mine. 40 minutes later, she stepped back, scrutinizing her handiwork. She twisted the lipstick back down in the tube.
"Yeah, I like it," she said. "What do you think?"
She moved aside so I could see my reflection in the mirror. I looked at myself. Suddenly I had these dramatic eyes, all the color of a maiden in the first blush of youth, dewy mouth, hair standing out in a dark wind-blown tumble. I cracked up.
"Go ahead and laugh," she said acidly. "You look damn good."
Dietz returned to the room at 7, glancing at us both without remark. Vera had done herself up in 6 minutes flat, her personal best, she said. She was wearing a black dress with a low-cut top filled to the brim with bulging breasts, black hose with a seam up the back, black spike heels. She stopped dead in her tracks and put her hands on her hips.
"What do you say, Dietz? Come on, cough it out."
"You look great. No shit. Both of you look swell."
"Swell doesn't even come close." And then to me, "I'll bet he still calls women gals."
"Not so far," I said. Dietz smiled to himself, but refused to engage. He propelled us across the hall and down 3 doors into the safety of the banquet room, which was small and elegant. Chandelier, white woodwork, walls padded in cream-colored silk. 6 tables for 6 had been laid out with a spray of orchids as the centerpiece. Each table was numbered, and I could see that place cards were set out, names in script. Many of the CF employees were already there, standing together in groups of 3 and 4, drinks in hand. I spotted Mac Voorhees and his wife Marie, Jewel and her husband, whom I'd only met once, Darcy Pascoe and her boyfriend, the allegedly dope-peddling mailman. Vera slipped her hand through Dietz's arm, and the 3 of us circled the room while everyone was introduced to everyone else, and we all promptly forgot who was who. I could see Vera doing an eyeball cruise, checking across the heads to see if Neil Hess had arrived yet. I was just hoping he'd be tall enough for her to spot. Dietz bought us each a drink. His was a plain soda water with lime, mine a white wine, and Vera's a tequila sunrise. She sucked that one down and bought herself another. I watched her with interest. I'd never seen Vera so tense. She turned to Dietz.
"God, how can you drink without smoking a cigarette?"
"This is an alcohol."
She rolled her eyes.
"That's even worse. I'm going to bum one," she said. "No, I'm not. Well, maybe one. A puff."
"Is that Neil?" I asked. A doctorish type was poised in the doorway, searching for a familiar face. Without a reference point, of course, it wasn't possible to tell just how short he was, but he looked okay to me. Pleasant face, dark hair cut stylishly. He wore a navy suit, pale blue shirt I could have bet would have monogrammed cuffs. The bow tie was unexpected. I hadn't seen one in years. Vera raised a hand. His face brightened when he spotted her. He made his way across the room while she moved to join him, tucking her arm in his when they connected at the midpoint. She had to bend a bit to talk to him, but the disparity in their heights didn't seem remarkable to me. I tried to picture him with his head on my pillow, but it really didn't wash. Chapter 17. Vera, in charge of the seating, had of course set it up so that Neil Hess and I were together. She and Dietz were at the table to our left.
Dietz had apparently interceded to some extent, arranging it so that I was secured in one corner of the room, facing the entrance. Dietz was seated with his back to me, facing the entrance as well, so he could keep an eye on the door. Vera was on his left, fully visible to me, while all I could see of him was the back of his head. Both tables flanked an emergency exit that the security director had assured Dietz would remain unlocked for us during the course of the banquet. By 8, everyone had arrived, and the assembled group settled at the tables like a flock of birds. The noise level had risen several decibels as a result of the alcohol consumed. These were company relationships, and there was a sense of giddiness and unease at the sudden shift from business to social behaviors. The three-course dinner was served at a leisurely pace. A salad of baby lettuces, boneless chicken breasts sautéed with lemon and capers, miniature vegetables, hot breads, and finally a dense chocolate cake in a puddle of vanilla sauce. I ate like a forest animal, head coming up to check the door at any sign of movement, worried that Mark Messenger would show up with an Uzi and mow us down like weeds. Judging from the set of Dietz's shoulders, he was more relaxed than I. But then he was staring down the front of Vera's dress, a titillating distraction for any man. I tuned into the conversation at the table. Neil and I had been seated with two underwriters and their wives, a foursome talking bridge with an intensity I envied. I gathered they'd just returned from some kind of bridge-oriented cruise in which baby slams and gourmet foods were served up in equal measure. Much talk of no-Trump double finesses and Scheinwald, whose strategies they were debating. Since neither Neil nor I played, we were left to our own devices, a possibility Vera had probably calculated well in advance. At close range, the man was attractive enough, though I saw no particular evidence of all the virtues Vera had ascribed to him. Nice hands, nice mouth. Seemed a bit self-satisfied, but that might have been discomfort masquerading as arrogance. I noticed that when we talked about professional matters, his work, in other words, he exuded confidence. When it came to his personal life, he was unsure of himself and usually shifted the subject to safer ground. By the time the dessert came, we were still groping our way through various conversational gambits, casting about for common interests without much success.
"Where'd you go to high school, Kinsey?"
"Santa Teresa High."
"I meant college."
"I didn't go to college."
"Oh, really? That surprises me. You seem smart enough."
"People don't hire me for smart. They hire me because I'm too dumb to know when to quit. Also, I'm a woman, so they think I'll work cheap." He laughed. I wasn't being funny, so I gave a little shrug. He pushed his dessert plate aside and took a sip of coffee.
"If you got a degree, you could write your own ticket, couldn't you?"
I looked at him. "A degree in what?"
"Criminalistics, I would guess."
"Then I'd have to go to work for the government or the local cops. I already did that and hated it. I'm better off where I am.